And now you've come into the anagarika life, homelessness through taking the 8 precepts formally in the middle of the Sangha as an act of making a formal commitment, which we call pakao, becoming a pakao, which actually in worldly terms simply means that you've got white dress right now, which in a way like you're doing what you've been doing before. You were dressed in white, you're already shaven as a lay visitor of the monastery. But to take the precepts formally and make this vow to train in the training precepts in front of the Sangha is another level of significance, both for yourself and for the community. It's like becoming more formally engaged and having the volition explicitly out there in front of the community. And we're welcoming you to take part in the community actions and the ways of living together on that level, much more than somebody just passes by and abides by the standards here in some way, but has never really mentioned explicitly, I do want to take this up as a training, sikkhapadang, as a training path. This is like the key factor of the whole monk's training as well, is that idea of a training path where you gradually kind of perfect yourself through abandoning the things that are unsuitable for the monastic form and abandon the household attitudes, getting more involved in the samana, sanya, and the perception of oneself as a renunciant, a peaceful practitioner who's gone another step away from the world. And the idea of having it as a training path means that in no way you can be perfect straight away. It's a training. Sikkha means the training, the education program, so to say. And what we affirm now is the sila sikkha, the training in the virtuous conduct that is appropriate for somebody who lives a monastic life. And it is quite difficult, maybe, to always keep those precepts in a perfect way, but important is to have the intention to train yourself. So, and that's very much the same with the monk's rules later, is that we are in no way free from defilements, in no way free from corruptions or inner poison drives or cravings and desires. And it so happens every now and again that we do miss especially the finer points of the precepts or the guidelines that the Buddha laid out there for us to keep. So in that sense, we practice to reset ourselves and immediately admit this wasn't quite right. And we start again with a sense of telling the community or another monk or another member of the community, like, I've done this and that, in the future I'll be restrained. So it's the good intention of keeping these things. That's a crucial factor of embarking on the training. It doesn't mean that one is perfect. In fact, it's a good way of constantly reminding oneself that one is aspiring to something much higher than just simply the conventional kind of act of speaking something in front of a group. But it's a training of the heart that gradually has to grow through one's own actions and through one's own also wrong actions. Like, so you gradually notice when you've overstepped some boundaries through having clearly stated those boundaries first. In the world, things are usually quite undefined. Anything goes. You get the freedom of doing whatever you like. And now this is like a self or group-imposed kind of framework which makes us realize very soon when we've kind of overstepped certain forms. Of course, the idea generally in the Buddhist training is to arrive at a point where the forms don't have any relevance for your state of mind, where you can be peaceful with anything that happens. But the way to get there is through keeping in line with the things that don't create conflict, for a sense of no remorse and a sense of delight in yourself and stilling of the worries that happen when you create trouble through other beings. And these are not only the community members, it's also any being, like say the first precept, for example, Panatipata, we're not killing any being, not even mosquitoes or whatever, you know, like any small living beings that we can see and that is good enough to catch our attention, we refrain from taking its life. So it's a very broad ethical concept which any Buddhist to a certain extent needs to take on anyway, but it becomes more explicit in the framework of living in a monastery and in the framework of not having a personal life in that sense as householders have. Like the term that we use for the pakao in Pali is the anagarika, and this is a term that means like somebody who does not have a house anymore, who doesn't live in a household framework, but he lives in the monastic framework, in the framework of this training rules. Yet there are anagarikas living out there in the world, famous anagarikas throughout the history of Buddhism. One of them is Anagarika Dhammapala, for example, who lived in India and revived the holy sites and the practice around them about 100 years ago, or whatever, you know. There's many ways of practicing, keeping those precepts for us in Wat Pananashad. It means entering the community that practices likewise to that level of keeping the 8 precepts as a training guideline for oneself, to perfect oneself in order to fulfill the threefold training of Sila, Samadhi and Panya for the sake of liberation. And it's a step away from worldly things, very much like which you'll see in the training precepts that you've just spoken in Pali. If we go through the meaning of the training precepts in English language and understand what the scope of it is much more than just simply things that you live by in ordinary life, which the 5 training precepts for any Buddhist are there, out there for as a means for liberation on the level of those people that are bound up with family, with house and work and things like that. Whereas we can take these things a little further, the 5 precepts become 8 precepts because there are certain ascetic practices which go away from worldly lifestyle involved. Explicitly the 6th, 7th and 8th precept, and the 3rd precept becomes more hard and fast, centered around the monastic etiquette in a way that we have not many social relations that we need to keep. Just the 3rd precept is about sexual relations, so we're in a group where sexual relations don't really matter because we don't have wife and kids, and more or less there's not much to think about in that sense. It can be more radical and going away, a step away from whatever average family men do. So, and the 6th, 7th and 8th training precept are a bit like the Dutanga practices a little bit, like in that sense, like voluntary practices for those that are training in a monastic form, a semi-monastic form, if people still say on the Uposatha day, like the lay people from Bungwai take these 8 precepts for a day, so it's compatible somehow with taking a step still in the world, having still one step in the world, one step in the monastic form. So it's a perfect way to test out, like, can I renounce some of the things that are common for people out there, but not in the model of training for somebody who walks the monastic path? So go through the precepts in the way that we undertake them like one by one, just as a sense of understanding that we are how we see them in the monastery, because there's so many ways of looking at them. And the Buddha's teachings, in many ways, they're open to a lot of interpretations, and you'll see that particularly in the forest tradition, there's a certain interpretation of the vinaya, the discipline or the training aspects of the monks, which we abide by in a common understanding. So this is also a chance now, becoming an anagarika with the eight precepts and the monastic etiquette, as a commitment to understand more what this conventional side of living together in the Sangha means. And you're welcome to always ask questions about the monastic etiquette and about the monks' training rules, so you can understand a little more how the framework gets more detailed as you move towards the yellow robes. So this is one thing that we do want the Pakhaos to participate in, the formal life of our Sangha, and the informal life with like the contacts to the monks and the Dhamma discussions also is anyway something that we nourish our inspiration by. And you're welcome to be closer to the Sangha in that sense anyway. But in terms of like understanding what the formal commitment in this particular way of seeing monastic way in the forest tradition is like, something you can gradually explore. And the eight training precepts, they do reflect parts of these. Like, so they're not really specified very well in detail in the scriptures, just as the Samanera precepts, they coincide with the Anagarika precepts, except for that the Samaneras take on another additional precept of renouncing to deal with gold and silver or money in these days. Whereas you yourself, you still keep your financial lifeline, because this is a kind of like a temporary commitment, so to say, for testing the waters and for living the form in a way that you can understand what's happening, so to make the next commitment if you feel ready to. So we don't give up money, and we don't give up our personal support system in that sense. So we're halfway in the Sangha, halfway still have one foot outside, but in our attitudes towards the training, we take it on fully to just move away from the world bit by bit, in order to see what it is like, whether we can live this lifestyle, whether we understand the meaning of it, and we see the benefits of stepping away one way from the things that we are used to, or the things that in, for example, like the Buddha spoke about, as like the not leading directly to the end of the suffering, of suffering, they're leading to samsara, the worldly attitudes. And the passage that you've just recited, the Sambhato Karavaso Rajopato, for example, you can find in the context of the Buddha talking about the noble search, the Arya Pariyasana, which takes you away from things that's like wives, slaves, cattle and crops and things like that, but it takes you to those things that are bound for the non-aging, non-dying, and the undefiled, and this is the search that we undertake in the practice. So the first training precept is about like not to take life of any form, and you already know that we do try to respect that very, very thoroughly. Like, we have that idea of like not killing even the slightest little creature. If we're consciously aware of it, sometimes may happen that you sweep the path and ants get tread on or die or so, but like, this is something we try to avoid. But life on this planet, life in samsara, in some way does need mean that there's also the ending of life, and but important is very much to keep your intention away from any killing process, like in living this lifestyle, living this life, this training path, to have a inclination towards non-violence in your actions, and be physically unintrusive and non-threatening, like in the way you conduct yourself. This is very much a principle of the samana, somebody who's peaceful and inviting people to trust, and you'll see that even animals can feel that attitude, and it's actually quite crucial to live the forest monk's life to have that attitude. Otherwise, you'd be getting into trouble. There's a lot of beings around in this world that do sense the intentions or nonverbal communication of a being entering their realm and entering their space. For example, we're living in the forest. We're actually guests here, just as any other creature. We don't have any entitlement. The kuti that we live in equally belongs to the spiders and scorpions and snakes. They don't have any sense of that. This is reserved for us. So to have that whole attitude of peaceful coexistence without harming any other being is very, very crucial for our life, being able to be sustained in the forest. And you'll see that spreading metta, loving kindness, using the protective chants to dispel the unwholesome attitudes in our minds towards other creatures, that's a very crucial part of the training, and that's the first precept in detail, so that we don't slap mosquitoes and things like that, like don't even give way to that feeling of like we get some extra comfort from you know, like being negligent towards the life of other beings. So we rather take the discomfort, rather suffer with a wholesome intention and a peaceful mind than having it comfortable and nice or free from possible threats. So that's something you'll get to experience more and more. And the second precept is about not taking what is not given, and to train oneself in not expecting to, or not be entitled to things, and in the worst case, not transgressing ownership, not to take anything that you're not quite clear of who it belongs to, or even volitionally know that it belongs to somebody else. And this also kind of involves communal possessions, say things like things that are lying around or so, like in the monastery, or things that are there for communal use. We develop that sense of caution, not just to simply feel it's all right to take them, but like if they haven't been really given to us or designated for us, or there's no permission to use them, we just don't do things, we just refrain from that. We can build up the attitude of, actually, I don't need anything, I've got what I need. The things that one is entitled to as a monastic are things like living on the foot of a tree, living from bindapata, from alms food, and living from rag robes, and living from, you know, fermented urine as a medicine. This is something that we'll gradually get to know more, how to get by with little. And so there's no sense of being entitled to possessions, even though we don't take a vow of possessionlessness as monks. There's a lot of training rules around things that we are allowed to have and that we are not allowed to have. And many of the things, of course, they have to do with the lifestyle as well, but generally they refer to an attitude of contentment, being somebody who's like easy to live wherever he goes, because he doesn't need much, and he'll experience that through having that little, that new pakao robe as well. These are your possessions, and the bowl and the sitting cloth and things like that. These are minimal requirements, and whereas the kutis and these things, we're just guests in there, like, and it's an attitude of non-possessing things and not infringing on the rights of other people, to taking what, you know, just in doubt about things. We in the world usually we think it's okay, we'll get by with it and we can just cut the corner somehow or do it when nobody sees it, and or just assume that it's all right. And generally our attitude now in the monastery is not to assume anything, just assume it's not all right, it's assume we don't need it. And so that's one mindset we move away from, worldly sense of entitlement to goods, so the respect that these goods may belong to other people, and creating an attitude of trustworthiness and non-conflict and in terms of our relation to the material worlds. And so the third precept is refraining from any sexual activity, which is the one that takes you into the realm of a monastic, somebody who practices the brahmacharya. The brahmacharya is a high ideal of being celibate and having nothing, no bonds on a personal, sensual relation with any being, and even with yourself, to refrain from sensual indulgence in the broader sense, but also in the sexual context. We don't have any sexual activity, even with ourselves. So I think that's one of the prides of the monastic orders of Buddhism, that we're very strict on things like masturbation and things like that. We don't just ever get close to that, and it's something I don't think is explicit in other monastic orders, in other religions. So at times these things are difficult, and at times it is kind of a challenge. Again, just search the advice of other monastics, and search the fulfillment in things that are non-sensual, like meditation, or sometimes it can be service, like where you sacrifice something on the physical level, like you go do some wood logging or so, in order to direct the energies that come up naturally in a physical body towards something that is neutral, or possibly something that kind of deviates it, the energies. Of course, we also have a lot of skillful means in meditation to build up a sense of independence from sensuality, which is a practice that you don't come across very much in household life, because they live with family, with wife and partners, and they have all kinds of ways of gratifying their desires, which are not considered unworthy or but for us, the ideal is just to be more or less using all the energy that usually goes into sexuality for something that's more uplifting, and that takes you away from bondage, takes you away from that feeling of being a slave of the desires, to go back to your own inner kind of refuge, the contentment that arises from just being by yourself and being able to use all the life force that you have in a way of transcending dukkha, rather than getting into dangerous areas where you get jealousy, you get a never-ending process of addiction possibly. So this is why the brahmacharya is considered such a high value, because it really takes you away from cravings, and which is, as you remember, one of the main teachings that the Buddha discovered in the light of his enlightenment, that dukkha arises because of tanha, craving, and one of the cravings is kama tanha, craving for sensuality. So we're willing to take that one step further than people out in the world that really do have to rely on that sense of partnership as a refuge, whereas we take a higher refuge, which is the teachings of the Buddha, the example of the Buddha, and the example of the Noble Sangha, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, is our kind of sense of where we rely on, if anything, and nothing in a worldly sense or in a physical sense. So sexual desires for, or sexual relations, are not only kind of explicit frivolous worldly sexual talk or things like that, or looking at things that are stimulating these things, which is fairly difficult in the monastery anyway. We don't have newspapers, we don't have media to provide that kind of access, which many people in the world do have constantly. but like to be restrained very much in the relation, like also to the lay women and to the villagers, the women that come on a daily basis. It's very, very good practice for an anagarika just to simply look away when somebody attractive coming along. Don't engage, don't necessarily kind of hang around there. Just kind of keep things functional, practical, and protect yourself from those automatic nature ingrained processes of cravings that it may trigger for the sense of peace and sense of like independence from that. And so physically we don't touch women, and that's something that anagarikas take on as well, and we don't speak to them when we're not necessary. And so we step away one way out of society, out of household or worldly life. So then we've got the precept of refining your speech, like not to speak any false speech or any coarse speech or any speech that is gossip or even idle chatter. As I mentioned the other day, Tirachana Katha, animal talk, as it is called in the scriptures, talks about whatever kings, robbers, thieves, politicians, so to say, all these things, like they're not part of our monastic training in that sense, that the Buddha saw these things are endless, and so we cut off an engagement even with our opinions and our chatting around these things. So idle chatter, sampapalapa, and it's part of the sub-specifications that are actually given for the eight precepts in regards to speech. So we refrain from that, or of course harsh speech, gossip, divisive speech, for the sense of unity and trustworthiness in the Sangha, in our mutual relationships. That's very important, to be somebody who is really reliable and truth, somebody who's bound up with truth in his speech. Very, very beautiful ideal, but difficult to keep. Sometimes there are worldly habits of exaggeration, or like making yourself into more than you are, or whatnot, boasting a bit, or twisting the truth a bit because you feel embarrassed. And if these things come up, you notice them and reset yourself and find a quiet time to tell somebody, actually, you know, I didn't mean that, and I'm sorry, in the future I won't say things like that again. It comes up quite a lot in the monastic training that one notices, especially speech patterns are very subconsciously ingrained, and once you've said something, you can't take it back. It sometimes leads to a whole chain reaction, which is definitely a karmic event, a landslide sometimes that can happen very easily. So to be very careful around speech and not to say anything that's wrong or even harsh or even hurtful is something very, very worthy of taking on. It creates a sense of trust and integrity with oneself and in relation to the others. So speech, musawata, false speech, to refrain from that. False in that sense that it also means speech that is that is violent, or speech that is divisive, or speech that is void of sense. So I cut that out for coming back to the essentials and to a sense of peace and truth, living in a sense of truthfulness. And then we've got like sura merya macha pamanatana, anything that's intoxicating and addictive, that we refrain from that. And for the monastery, this also means smoking. So all the anagarikas are absolutely prohibited from smoking. Also, when you go outside right now, you're representing the anagarika training. It stays with you because you're embarked on this. And so if you have to do business in town or so, all these precepts, whether it's the one about not using intoxicants, or whether it's the one about like not eating in the afternoon or things like that, it's very important. You're also quite supported by this whole monastic commitment, in that sense that lay people are sponsoring our lifestyle here very, very generously, and they know the standards, so, and they know that it's a life project of 24 hours a day. You can't just switch on and off and find a corner where you're able kind of to still do things that other in other areas don't fit. So there's the sense of consistency. So especially with smoking, I'm very, very strict. If I see anybody with a cigarette, he's out, more or less. Like that's it. It's a good test for oneself to be able to get away from addictions, test one's inner strength. That's the way we do things here. Like, so this, then the other intoxications, like, then generally not available, but of course need to be mentioned. There's no alcohol and nothing that's, and anything that has to do with drugs, which in some of the monasteries starts getting a problem with young village lads being possibly drug addicts or so coming into the form. I trust that everybody here has stepped away from that, even though one may have had addictions in the past. This is the time to absolutely keep things clear and make a fresh start. So the reason why we take up this training, not to have addictive substances support us in our well-being, so to say, you know, people argue like LSD in the 70s was considered to be mind-enhancing and things like that. We just want to be independent and do this from the strength of our own mind and be able to access our resources as they are there in natural, in nature, and not have that overkill of whatever influences from outside and to be dependent on those. And it is very much the strength of mind, the clarity of mind that is inherent with each and every life that we want to be able to access. And it's a very uplifting feeling to be able to do that, to step beyond the ordinary consciousness through the power of mind is all we're trying to do when we're meditating. So it's counteractive towards meditation if we take intoxicating substances. That's one of it. But you'll see in the monastic life there's a there's other addictions that can come up in that sense, that people get addicted to coffee, caffeine and things like that, or sugar and all kinds of things. Of course, they're not in that precept. That would be impractical to kind of like draw the line that rigid, but it, like, in the sense of being independent in oneself, it's very good to keep one's mind clear from all these things that are possibly kind of creating cravings that are kind of beyond the normal daily engagement. So say something that becomes into a habit of addiction, having to have a cup of coffee or having to have a cup of tea or so, or Emroy Hasip. Our monastery is Emroy Hasip free, and these are these kind of high caffeine power drugs that truck drivers need for their long journeys, and we just don't have them here. So the five precepts are now complete, but they're a bit more refined, a bit more kind of going to the center of a spiritual life that does away with worldly things. So, and the sixth to eighth precept are explicit, more about like some kind of ascetic lifestyle where you test the waters of living with less comfort than household life and less distraction. And one of them is not eating in the afternoon. Like, afternoon formally is 12 o'clock, or like as a convention in our group of monastery, we define it like that, 12 o'clock. For the monastery itself, it's very easy to keep it because we just have the one meal a day practice as a dutanga practice for the monks, which is a voluntary thing in the training of monks. But there's a permission that the Buddha gave to have certain monasteries just take on certain ascetic practices, and those who want to join them are welcome. Those who don't want to are welcome to go somewhere else. So we've got it extra to the point we just eat once a day at 8 o'clock, and every now and again say on Katina Day, New Year's Day, sometimes you see that there's an official exception to that, but like apart from that, we don't eat anything, even though you as an anagarika have access to a lot of things in the kitchen, and possibly temptations come around food quite a bit, to the level of people even stealing food and snatching it away, which is preaching on the first precept in a much more direct way. But like to be able to help yourself every now and again with a spoonful of that, this and that, something that the pakaos are specifically in danger areas, because you have to deal with the kitchen. For the monks, we're far away from that. We don't even enter the kitchen or touch the fridge or so. So it's very clear also that Bindabad food is usually after the alms round. Everybody renounces his share of food. It becomes communal. And then we receive it again at 8 o'clock. So no biscuits, no three-in-ones, nothing at the side for us. Like, we just keep it very clear for the sake of our own training and seeing the boundaries. So, this one also, when you go to town and you got some business, it's very important that like the faithful lay people that know Wat Banachat all over Ubon, all over Isan, or even in Bangkok, they don't see you with an ice cream at 3 o'clock or so. That it's very important. That may destroy their faith quite a lot. Or like a milk coffee, that's we consider milk to be part of food. So there's more to say about it. It's a big discussion in the Vinaya what counts as food and what not. But we take the standards of the monks for the anagarika in defining what is food and not, and the 12 o'clock cutoff time. Whereas on the regular routine, it's even more exaggerated that we only eat at the communal times in the sala, not in the kuti, nowhere else, just together, unless there's kind of sickness or like circumstances that kind of require it. Then we can always talk about it if, say, hospital stays and things like that may be different. So that's the sixth precept. The seventh precept is all about this kind of worldly things that spin around fantasies, make one attached to sensuality in a less coarse way than sexuality, but sensuality in terms of entertainment, sounds, smells, tastes, odors, tangibles, and the whole thing about communication, communication devices. We're very strict in that sense that we don't want people to be able to watch videos and even whatever. Right, other things on the internet or so we don't have all these devices. It does count somehow into that precept that we abandon all the entertainment, music, singing, dancing, shows and movies and things like that for the sake of living out in nature, to have a natural sense of relating to the things that are there already in with our life, and to directly experience them, not through any extra kind of embellished and trivialized way, which does make us not experience dukkha, that we want it to become apparent for us, to be able to transcend it and to be able to go against our tendencies to love sukha, love pleasure, and not be able to put up with dukkha, with discomfort and frustration, or like sensory deprivation and things like that. Is something that they fear a lot in the world, whereas we actually love it. We close our eyes, find it conducive to meditation if there's less input. So that seventh precept is very crucial for facilitating meditation. We constantly are bound up with the things that are stimulating the desires through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and mind, and then we won't be able to shut down and get the more refined gratification of living on the breath, on nothing actually. And in terms of requisites, like we're forest monks. We live in a natural setting. We're not living in a city where you got like lots of cars and advertisement and things like that. So it's quite easy to see the benefits of simply listening to the sounds of nature, knowing how, you know, the temperature feels. We don't have air condition, or we don't have fans, and we don't have light, electric light in the kutis. We keep it basic. We're living a kind of recluse's life, like a hermit. Even though Wat Pananachat is in a kind of park-like setting, it's like more like a reservoir for hermits. We're not really out in the wild here, but you'll be able to experience that as well. We've got branch monasteries where we just live with a mosquito net in the jungle without any contact to other monks or anagarikas. So that it is important not to be dependent on these things. So that's why we take this seventh precept very strict. So no singing, dancing, no whistling, no perfumes, like say no deodorant. We just use the alum stone. We do use soap. Not so strict with that, but like in terms of any other things, like whatever, like little rings, earrings, or whatnot, we take off. I would say these days, like, to make yourself a new tattoo while you're a pakao is breaking the precept. That's my understanding of it. Like whatever one has already is kind of up to the day and age these days. Like people come bintut, like adi, kind of with all kind of bintuing is a word to like we use for the robes. We make little marks on the robe to show that it's ours, and people in the world, they've got the attitude that they can mark their body and showing it's my body, it looks like this and that. We don't do that as a monastic anymore, like, but whatever one has and brings along, we're fine with that. But like, just to put it on your consciousness, how easily one has a sense of like manipulating, kind of customizing one's life, one's requisites with things that are kind of embellishing them, and we try to live without that. Like that's why we've got this very simple dress. White is very neutral, a sign of the old brahmacharyas in India. Yogis take white robes and possibly later yellow robes, and as a symbol of renunciation, so we don't have like bright colors around in the monastery. Something that possibly one isn't aware of, but it conduces to a sense of like being kind of grounded in simplicity, and that's all related to that seventh precept. The eighth precept is kind of in line with that. It's explicitly about sleeping on the floor, not sleeping on beds, and not having big furniture. And it's also an advantage if you look at this, how it makes you able just to crash out anywhere. You can find a corner somewhere on the concrete floor and with whatever, nothing on, underneath, you know, to, you know, like which we do at the Katinas many times, sleeping like the dogs somewhere in the corner, which is pretty cool to be able to do that rather than having to have a room which is decorated and lots of mattresses which then need to be maintained and washed and put away. So we're just kind of able to sleep anywhere, or like generally the idea between of the eighth precept is not to make it too comfortable to find sleep, because sleep usually triggers sensual desires as well, dreams and things like that. And this is famous quote, I think it's King Pasenadi after that the Buddha gives a Dhammapada verse actually too, and says like after having eaten and indulged in the sensual desires, they sleep and snore like pigs. So we try to be more dignified and be somebody who's devoted to wakefulness, Jagarayana Yoga, and that that framework of sleeping not comfortable, not seeking comfort in sleep, helps that a lot, to be always ready to get up and rather sit than sleep. And something where we try to put the framework such that it's not an area where we get addicted to comfort again, and explicitly with sitting and sleeping. But if you've got physical hardships with the aging body, there's also things what we can do, like with pillows and mats every now and again. Just then ask what to do. Say if your bones are aching, if you're sick and you got a physical disability and things like that, then we can talk about it. But like not as a regular thing that we just kind of take that for granted, that we we can sleep in high luxurious beds. That's the precept. And going on a journey, say many times you find yourself, say you go on a pilgrimage to India, you find yourself in cheap luxury hotels with beds. Usually the monks, they just sleep on the rack, which is super filthy in India, on the floor besides the big luxury beds. So I find that's pretty impressive and pretty cool actually to be able to do that. And so that's open for you as a training as well right now. So I've gone through all of the precepts. If there are any more questions in the way we take them, or like definitely you'll get feedback if you do something that is at odds with the understanding of the Sangha, we'll let you know. But take this kind of little kind of criticism or pointing out like mistakes as information, because you're new to this, you don't know all these things, and your main motivation is to perfect yourself in these things. And of course we're never perfect, and the monks as well, they always need to live with their own mistakes and with the things that the friends in the holy life, they point out towards you. And it's considered growth in the holy life to see one's own mistakes and to be able to correct them and be restrained in the future. And it's also a skill to learn while you're in the community, to live with the shortcomings of others and with yourself, and then be able to constructively increase the wholesome and abandon the unwholesome. The Sangha is very happy to have you in the midst on a more formal basis. Like, I think it's a worthwhile step to test the waters, to to find how much the commitment actually involves, and whether it's like liable to bring about growth in our heart, or whether it feels inappropriate for us. You're always free, you know, to abandon the training precepts, but while you take them, you have to live up to them. That's kind of the point about commitment, and they count continually. There's no holiday. Once you've taken them on as a prakar, we consider them they're there. It's not like when you leave the monastery, you can go back to five precepts or so. It's just part of the special status as a prakar, that you're formally a member of the community. And in that sense, we'd like to welcome you and wish you all the best. May all these kind of conventional realities be a stepping stone to liberation, where we don't need the conventions anymore, and may you grow in the threefold training. So having taken the Anagarika precepts formally from the Sangha, we'd all like to give you our blessing now for chanting a welcome chant to the Sangha. And that's about it for the instruction today.